Tweet at TodaySOR.
Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know is the latest book from the best-selling author and journalist Malcolm Gladwell. It explores why we are so bad at judging people and the devastating consequences that can have. Malcolm Gladwell, you're very welcome to studio. Thank you so much indeed for coming in.
Delighted to be here.
Is your advice for talking to strangers simply that we should be more aware of our failure to accurately see into the world of a stranger, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's more to it than that. You know, that's one of the themes of the book. But another of the themes of the book is that we are, as human beings, built to trust people. And that's a lovely thing. That is the source of almost all that's good in our world. But it means that every now and again, we will be deceived by someone, by some kind of sociopath. And we should not, when that happens, we shouldn't consider that a failure of the way we are, or a reason to change. We should just accept that as the price of being human. And that's a kind of complicated idea to explain at a time when we do get deceived, we tend to have the opposite reaction, to think that we've done something profoundly wrong.
Very early in this book, you highlight one of the, I suppose, great catastrophic misjudgments. That was the British Prime Minister going to meet Hitler.
Yes.
And thinking that they had done a deal and they'd done the handshake, and literally months later, the world was at war.
Yeah.
And that man's reputation is ruined for the rest of time, you could say.
Yeah. Well, there I was in that story, the story of Neville Chamberlain's famous visit to Hitler in 1938, when he returned home and said, you know, I looked this man in the eye, I believe he wants peace. You know, rarely has there been a more sort of public example of getting someone wrong. I was very interested in that chapter, in this great paradox, which is the people who saw Hitler for who he really was, people like Churchill or the American president Roosevelt, never met him. The people who were deceived by Hitler were the people who had met him. So Chamberlain had met him, was deceived. The Canadian prime minister had met him, was in love with Hitler. All of the diplomatic staff of Chamberlain, the British ambassador to Germany, had met him and thought that he wanted peace. And this was this curious idea that there may be times when we are clearest about strangers when we don't meet them. In other words, something about a face-to-face encounter with a stranger is not helping us in our understanding of them. Perhaps it's hurting us. Chamberlain would have been better off staying at home and reading Mein Kampf. You know, that would have given, you know, if he'd been a little more bookish and a little less certain of his social abilities, we might all be better off.
There's a passage in this book about halfway through, and you're quoting one expert saying that we tend to judge people's honesty based on their demeanor. Well-spoken, confident people with a firm handshake who are friendly and engaging are seen as believable. Nervous, shifty, stammering, uncomfortable people who give windy, convoluted explanations aren't.
Yes, that's so. It's sort of an obvious point, but there's this fascinating fact that when you... And there have been a number of studies that have looked at, that have kind of questioned police officers from around the world, almost every country you can imagine, and said to them, when you're interrogating a suspect, are there signs that you use as indications of deception? And overwhelmingly, police officers from almost any culture will say, yes. If I'm looking at someone and they're averting their eyes, or they're shifting nervously in their seat, or they're fiddling with their hands, I use that as an indication that they're probably lying to me. Now, as it turns out, we have very good data on whether those kinds of, that kind of body language lines up with deception. It does not. It tells you nothing about someone, about the veracity of their speech, if they're averting their eyes. But nonetheless, we're convinced it does.
And you highlight the case of Amanda Knox, a very well-known case, a young woman from the United States who was jailed for 4 years in Italy, found guilty of murdering a housemate. Mm-hmm. She had nothing to do with it.
She did. And there is a classic case of... She was someone, and the word that psychologists use to describe her is mismatched. A mismatched person is someone whose body language and facial expressions don't line up with their internal emotional states. So these are people who, when they are happy, don't necessarily smile from from ear to ear. When they are sad, they don't frown. They're just a little bit. There is a mismatch between their representation of emotion and their emotions. Lots of people are this way. It's not a sign of anything wrong with you. It's just a kind of indication of the marvelous diversity of human beings. She was one of those people. It so happened, though, that her roommate was murdered, and she didn't behave in the aftermath of the death the way the Italian police and the British tabloid press thought that someone ought to behave. She, as a result, was convicted of a crime she didn't commit and spent 4 years in jail.
Even though there were no forensics?
There was no physical evidence that linked her to the crime. She was quite literally put in jail because her people looked at the way she behaved and thought, oh, she's behaving as a guilty person would.
You also highlight the case of a woman called Sandra Bland, who was a young woman of colour who was driving along one day and was pulled over.
Mm-hmm. And this is in rural Texas, pulled over by a white police officer for a failure to signal, the most trivial of infractions. And it starts out as you'd expect, you know, ma'am, can I see your driver's license? And within 30 seconds, they're in a shouting match. And within a minute, he's dragging her out of the car, arresting her, putting her in prison. And then she hangs herself in her cell 3 days later. It was a case that reverberated around the United States, made headlines. And that is the signature case of this book. I begin and I end with that case because it's a classic example of an encounter between two strangers that goes wrong. And I'm trying to answer the question, why does it go wrong? And I think it goes wrong for reasons that are applicable to many different kinds of stranger encounters. And that case, it's also a kind of extraordinary case to look at because it's so tragic. And the officer's desk cam video captured the entire exchange. And so we know exactly how the two of them went off the rails. And that's why I sort of chose to make that case my...
And was it a problem with his disposition or his training or what was it?
It was two things. It was his training in large part. It was in small part his disposition. He wasn't someone who had particularly good interpersonal skills. But fundamentally, though, the mistakes he made were mistakes we all make. It's just that in his case, he was dealing with a high-stakes situation, you know, where he's trying to arrest someone, and most of us are never in high-stakes situations. So he committed the crime of reading too deeply into a stranger's facial expressions. He perceived her to be behaving oddly and concluded that she must have some malicious intent. She must be dangerous, have drugs, a gun. In fact, she was just upset. So he confused malice with anxiety. Right? A pretty fundamental mistake. But he made that mistake because he did this thing that we do all the time, which is he looked at a stranger's facial expressions and body language and said, oh, I know what that means. But in truth, we don't know. We can look at a loved one and know what that means, but we can't look at a stranger and know what that means.
And there is this thing as well that certain approaches to policing will put police officers in particular areas that maybe have a bad reputation and therefore they expect certain bad behaviours.
Yeah. So I get into as well in the last part of the book the implications for police practice. So if we're bad at... the job of a policeman is to confront a stranger, right? That's their job. And if we're bad at that, how should we then direct police activity? And I get into some fascinating theories from criminology about how crime is extraordinarily predictable. And in any urban area that has ever been tested, over 50% of the crime happens on less than 2% of the city blocks. And what that says is it is entirely appropriate to have an aggressive, proactive police presence on those tiny majority of streets where there's lots of crime. It is not appropriate anywhere else. And this was where this woman was stopped was not an area that had lots of crime.
Yeah, but coming back to the point, and this, I suppose, has more to do with Amanda Knox than Sandra Bland, So many body language experts, you know, will take the view they can tell you an awful lot about what a person is thinking and what they're feeling by their body language.
Yeah, I think that's nonsense. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who make that
he
claim.
He looked shifty. He looked guilty.
Exactly. It's nonsense. I mean, there's a whole body of very rigorous psychological work now which has examined each of those claims in exacting detail and concluded that whole notion is bonkers. These people are spreading the worst kind of mythology.
You highlight several cases, particularly to do with Cuba, where the intelligence services got the complete runaround from Cuban agents and indeed Cuban counter agents at the very highest level in the Pentagon.
So this is sort of proves my point. I tell a number of spy stories in the book that are all about how the CIA was profoundly misled by the Cuban intelligence service on a number of occasions. And they were, and not when I say profoundly, I mean they were fooled on an epic scale, not just one time with one person, but over and over again, over many, many years. And the question is, if the most sophisticated spy service in the world, which is, you know, on actively looking for people who are trying to deceive them, if they can have the wool pulled over their eyes by the Cubans over the course of many, many years, repeated times, what hope do the rest of us have of detecting deception? So I think it's time for us to concede that we can't do it and we should adjust our lives accordingly.
And these were people, in some cases, that were working in Cuba themselves. I mean, CIA agents who thought they had, you know, certain contacts and giving them information. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the Cubans were up to them the whole way.
It's an extraordinary story. I tell the story of what is perhaps the most extraordinary humiliation of the Cold War, where the United States put together a network of spies inside Cuba, and it turned out, they learned to their great dismay, every single one of them was a double agent working for Castro. It's an unbelievable. And I don't think there's ever been a case where an entire network was revealed to be double agents.
And the Cubans could prove it.
Oh my goodness! They were following them around. They were following the American CIA agents around with television crews, without their knowledge, filming their every move. And they later put a 10-part documentary on Cuban television, which exposed the entire American spying operation.
And then there was this woman who was working at a very high level, and there were suspicions, but nothing really that caused alarm. And she got away with it for another, was it 4 years?
And it was for 9 years, yeah. She might have been a woman named Ana Montes who might have been, I mean, up there with Kim Philby in terms of how damaging she was to the interests of the West.
And the other thing is, away from the spy stories, there's a man called Bernie Madoff who got a very long sentence for running illegal financial arrangements. And again, he was somebody who had great credibility. There were journalists who were told, I think you say in the book, look, investigate this guy. And they just couldn't bring themselves to believe.
So this idea I play with in the book is a very important one. It's called default to truth. And it says that as human beings, we evolved to have as a default position that everyone we're talking to is who they are, who they say they are, right? That's we're hardwired to believe. And if we weren't hardwired to believe, we couldn't do anything in society. If I wasn't hardwired to believe that you are Sean and that you have a national radio show on Irish radio, I wouldn't have come in the room. I would have spent all my time making phone calls to verify that you are, you know, I would have been Googling you furiously to make sure your picture was, you know, and then we would have been 20 minutes late. You'd have been so angry with me, you would have canceled the interview. I mean, on and on and on and on. You also trust that I am who I say I am, right? I mean, you didn't Google my picture to make sure, oh, is it Malcolm?
But I mean, if Chamberlain can be fooled the way he was by Hitler, if the best brains in American intelligence can be fooled by Castro and his people, what hope is there for the rest of us? I mean, like, are you saying that we should just take everybody at face value? And if sometimes we're wrong, as you were saying at the start, well, that's life.
I think that is the right position, because the number of people who are Hitler's or Bernie Madoff's is vanishingly small. And the benefits of being trusting, implicitly trusting, are so large that we can afford to pay the occasional price of being deceived. I mean, how many times have you ever had a guest on your radio show who was not who they said they were, right? Has it ever happened?
I can't recall. I could name a few who promised to come on the show on the basis of a firm handshake and then it didn't materialise or weren't available when we went looking for them and that kind of thing.
But your career has not been derailed by the fact that you trust your guests, has it? I mean, and in fact, the fact that you do enjoy what you do and trust the people who come in is what makes the show work. Well, that's true of all of us.
Well, there are other presenters who would have made a career, Malcolm, out of saying or taking the view of virtually all their interviewees, who is this bastard? And why is he lying to me?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think those people last a long time in the media? I don't know. I think they and they pay a terrible price of being disliked. I mean, who wants to go home at night thinking that everyone thinks that they're obnoxious and unpleasant?
So, is this really leading up to the conclusion finally that look, you know, there's good in everybody. Occasionally, it doesn't maybe surface to the top and. Don't take it too personally if you're wrong in the way you judge people.
Yeah. I think we will inevitably have, in the course of living our lives, situations where we are deceived. The worst thing we can do is to turn into paranoid and suspicious people. We need to maintain our faith in our own trusting souls.
The book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. It's published by Alan Lane. It's available now. Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much indeed for coming to studio.
Thank you, Sean.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.